Okay, cool. I'm going to do my radio voice. Is that fine?
Do it.
Welcome to the Hometown Hollywood Podcast, where you can find advice, inspiration, and strategies for success from talented people that are making a name for themselves inside the film industry, but outside of the major film cities. Here's your host, Travis Myers!
Man, that was the most enthusiastic read I've ever had.
Hey, my name is Travis Myers, and this is the Hometown Hollywood Podcast. Today's guest is Wilson Lemieux, an executive producer at his properly named Lemieux Company in Amarillo, Texas. Wilson is someone I knew I had to get on the show because if you know him at all, you know he is the embodiment of what this show is all about. He is making the film dream happen in his own hometown by doing incredible work that can compete with the best. I love getting to hear his story, and I was inspired by the confidence that he had in himself and his team. You can tell in this interview that his relationships with others means everything to him, and he invests a lot in other people. As a little note, before we started recording the interview, we hadn't been talking for more than 5 minutes, and he was already giving me encouragement and advice that I really needed to hear, and I believe that speaks a lot about his character. In this interview, you'll learn about how to start a company with $600 to your name, going from one-man band DSLR shoots to a full crew big-budget productions in 1 year, the best body shop ad you will ever see in your life, how working in a small town can actually present you with an accelerated opportunity for growth, the importance of gushers on set, how to be intentional in your work and with your family, and the importance of building a team and letting your hitters hit. If you get to the end of this podcast and don't understand how important it is to invest in the relationships you have with other people, then you have completely missed the point, and I would invite you to restart the episode and try again. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did, so let's get right into the show.
Wilson, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on and finally get a chance to meet you virtually. One thing I've noticed about the guests that I've had on is your last name is Lemieux, right?
Yes, sir.
That's French, isn't it?
Well, you know, if we're being honest, it's probably more Cajun. We're not that classy to be French, but that's the. I think it's from French origin for sure, right? But I always try to make the joke that we're not classy enough to be French. we're more Cajun for sure.
Well, I've noticed, like, I had JP on the show. He's from Louisiana. Definitely got that Cajun influence. I've had Logan LeBlanc. That's a French last name, Cajun influence. And then I've had Nick Pilecki from Canada, a French influence for sure. And then I'm going to have Dylan. I don't know how to say his last name yet, but I will. He's done a couple music videos in French. So I'm starting to wonder, is that the secret to the film industry? Is some type of French or Cajun influence?
Well, I think that, you know, for you, I think the secret to success for your podcast is to continue with the French-Cajun sympathy here. you know, all of us French boys out here, we need some work, dude. So you just keep it up, and I'm sure the good vibes will come.
All right. So looking at your work this morning, I spent quite a lot of time just looking at your website and Vimeo, and you just seem to be the embodiment of what this show is about, making it happen in areas other than L.A., New York, Hollywood, whatever the big cities are. I even saw one of the pictures on your Instagram was, what did it say? We ain't from Hollywood.
Yes.
So what is your why for living and working in Amarillo? Why not go to the big cities when you're doing work that's obviously at that level?
So I think that the reason my work is at that level is because I'm from Amarillo and in Amarillo. You know, when I did video in college, I was kind of like the video guy, right? Because I knew how a DSLR worked and had a little bit of experience in Premiere Pro. And so in college, I was on like advertising teams, and I would, you know, create our mock commercials to take to competition. And I would, you know, think creatively and do stuff and do whatever you could with just your little 70 and all that kind of stuff, and had a great time doing it. Then I went to New York for an internship, but I'd started dating who would eventually be my wife right before I went, and she had, at the time, a three-year-old little boy, and I had a job offer in New York with a entertainment marketing firm that at the time was kind of like my dream job, right? But I knew that I didn't want to, you know, I'm from tiny time. I mean, Amarillo is like 200,000 people, but I grew up in a town of 1,500. And so I didn't feel like I was prepared, because I knew I was going to marry Heather. And so I didn't want to bring her and Madden up to New York when I, you know, didn't necessarily have a lot of New York living experience, that far away from anybody that we knew. And so I came back home, didn't take the job, came back home, and got a job as a marketing director for a bank equipment company, because I just wanted to take care of her and provide. But over time I realized that, man, I kind of miss, or I want this opportunity to build something for myself. And so I eventually left the bank equipment company with like $600 in the bank account. Oh, we had another baby on the way. No real clients. But I had a buddy of mine that basically fronted me $6,000 and became my business partner, and kind of taught me how to do business stuff and helped get me in the door to a lot of folks around town to start doing videos, essentially as a freelance video guy. But I branded myself as Lemieux Company. I didn't brand myself as Wilson the video guy. And over time, opportunities started to come. Things started to present themselves. And all that while, I was building a network outside of Amarillo, and paying attention to what folks were doing, whether it was in Charlotte, North Carolina, New Orleans, Dallas, Houston, LA, New York, et cetera. I was like, okay, these guys work, or these girls work, these folks work are better than mine. Why? How? And over time, I started getting bigger budgets to do stuff. And then we got a commercial called from Amarillo National Bank that ended up being called Boring as Hell. And that kind of changed my life as a creator, and kind of helped establish whatever reputation it is that I have. And I'd met a guy named Jared Hogan at a conference in Dallas 2 or 3 years prior. He had just gone freelance, and I reached out to him and said, yo, I don't know how to direct. I don't even know how an Alexa Mini works. I don't know what I need to do. Can you come help me? I have this vision, but I have no idea whatsoever in executing it, or how to execute it. I have no idea how to execute it. And so Jared came and kind of taught me how a set worked and how things looked. And we cobbled together some dudes from Amarillo. Some knew a little bit more about how it worked than I did. And we did the thing, right? And still to this day, I think it might be the best commercial I've ever directed, and the first commercial I ever directed. And the reason it was successful is because Amarillo took a shot on me, right? Amarillo National Bank took a shot on me. This town in general has taken a shot on me over the last 5.5 years. And we've been able to take what I've learned from homies kind of across the country, mixed with this opportunity to be able to bless them with work, and they've helped me. And these are opportunities I don't think that I would have had in LA, Dallas, New York, wherever. Yeah. Amarillo allowed me to kind of be a bigger sized fish in a pond that at the time hadn't seen a lot of creative advertising that way. And then we created Boring as Hell. It was a hit, and that led to so many other different things that you see on the reel now, or on the website now. But all of that to say is my work looks national, or looks high quality, or whatever, right? And it looks that way because Amarillo took its shot on me, and I was able to be scrappy and make it happen here. Whereas, you know, at the time that I got hired to do Boring as Hell, my skills weren't in a place, I don't think, that I would have been hired to do that kind of commercial in Dallas or in any other bigger market. And so Amarillo's taken that shot on me and I've just tried to make the most of it.
I really enjoyed that commercial. I watched it probably three times this morning. It's very funny, and at least for a bank, like most of the time you see bank commercials and they're very serious and try to polish them up to make them look like they have no flaws. But this one was just like, look, what we do is kind of boring and we're owning it. And you nailed that.
They're a great bank. They take great care of people. I could promise you that. And what's so cool about Amarillo National Bank is that they're, look at me, I'm just going to go sell for them. But they don't have any shareholders, and they care about their folks more than they care about impressing anybody else. And especially during the pandemic, I mean, they were a like pillar of security for so many folks here when everything hit the fan back in March. And I couldn't brag on them enough, whether I ever do another commercial for them or not. I mean, they're just a really great, great, great financial institution. Actually, they're the number one largest independently owned financial institution in the country. And wow. their brand overall, especially here in Amarillo, is just like, look, we are who we are. We're going to make fun of ourselves when it's time to make fun of ourselves. But when it's time to make sure folks get taken care of, we're going to do that with the utmost respect and care and seriousness. And I'll tell you, man, I've loved being able to work for them because their commercials are very much so unique to them. I don't think that you see any advertising in general from any other kind of financial institution that's quite like Amarillo National Banks. They're so absolutely in tune to their brand and their team that they have there, from writers to the, you know, Ton is her name, who's running the show up there. They just have a complete and very thorough understanding of how they want to present themselves. And it's when we work with them, and you'll see a lot of their kind of work on our website. It's just like, we know what we're going to do. We know how it's going to sound. We know what it's going to look like. And every time, it's so much fun. And I think a lot of times you don't see clients that have as clear a vision of that, at least that we've worked with, as they do.
I can see that from the work. Does it look like they're having fun making that content with you? Is that something that they come to you like, hey, this is exactly what we want here, or we've written out the script, we want you to make it happen? Or is it like, hey, we have a general idea, what can you do to make it better? How does the creative process work with that?
So sometimes, you know, with Boring as Hell, they're like, here's the script, what can you do with it? And then we did Boring as Hell. Other times it's been like, hey, will you come in from the writing process and we'll walk through kind of what everything looks like. We know we want to accomplish X, Y, and Z goal. How can we communicate that? Other times it's like, you know, we're sitting in a room brainstorming for 20 or 30 minutes and I write 4 to 5 different treatments and pitch it to them. It just depends, right, on, you know, the circumstance, right? So, a lot of times we're going direct to client. A lot of times we're sitting in those meetings with the client, figuring out, you know, the best way to communicate their needs, and then also executing the production. But then sometimes we're just given a script, say pitch to the script and see what you can do.
So all of the above, basically.
Yes. Yes.
So one ad I saw on your website that probably shocked me the most was the Loki body shop.
Yes.
I watched that and I was like, man, this is beautiful. And then it's like, it's a body shop. This is the most beautiful commercial I've ever seen for a body shop and probably will ever see. Could you describe just making that commercial and, I don't know, the why behind it, how you got a body shop commercial, which are normally all the body shop commercials I've ever seen have been as corny and low quality as possible. And this just like takes it to a whole nother level. So how did that project come to be?
So I didn't direct that. A buddy of mine named Matthew Rojas directed it. I came in as the creative director, and executive producer on that job. And so I'd kind of created the sandbox through which Matthew could pitch. And we knew that we wanted to kind of embody the city of Amarillo. We knew we wanted to show the kind of work that these folks do. We know we wanted to kind of create a hero within the kind of Loki's brand, all of that kind of stuff that you show, but then tie it back to, people and cars. Because when you make a purchasing decision on a body shop, it's a painful decision. You're not going there because you're brand loyal per se, right? At least in the beginning. And the goal was to generate consideration and new customers. And so we wanted to be able to, and especially up here in the Texas Panhandle, a lot of people love being Amarilloan, right? Like, we're proud to be here in Amarillo. There's a bank called Amarillo National Bank, right? Like, one of the cool things about Amarillo in general is that we've run a lot of chains out of town for the sake of investing in the homegrown companies, right? I'm one of those, and Loki's Body Shop is that too, right? And so the goal was to be able to position Loki's Body Shop as Amarillo's Body Shop. And so one of the lines in the script was, you know, the hands that keep Amarillo moving. But the story, when you think about what, when you go to a body shop, you're just, you're there because you're in a wreck. And so we wanted to be able to tell the story of how, like, you know, this kid never saw Loki's Body Shop. This dad, they're going out to the canyon to go see some stuff. Loki's Body Shop enables that, right? Like, you can drive there like nothing ever happened to the car. And so I'd kind of set that box up, and then Rojas created this story around that. And it turned out really awesome. John Carrington shot it. We did it over 2 days in Amarillo using primarily local crew outside of those two guys. And it was a blast, right? It was so much fun to be able to do. And Matthew runs a great set, and he and I have a great relationship. And so it's really easy for he and I to collaborate and talk, because a lot of times we're just on the same page.
The production, the ideas going into it, that all just meshed perfectly, because like I said, I don't know if I've ever seen a better body shop ad, or ever will see one that rivals it. I felt like I was from Amarillo watching it. Like, man, this is my hometown. Oh, wait, I don't think I've ever even been there.
Well, come on up, brother. So, wait, though. Our coronavirus
selling me.
Our coronavirus cases are pretty high right now, so maybe dial it back till things slow back down.
Okay. I just booked a flight, but I guess I'll cancel it. So there are some ads through your company that you direct, some you produce as a creative director. Can you talk about the difference between the two, how you approach each of them? Because there seems to be a lot of work and creativity in both. What are things you love about each?
Any job that you've seen in our reel, any job that you see on Lemieux Company's website, it's happened because I've had to sell it, right? Obviously. But we've had to broker the relationship, direct to client. We've had to, you know, of course, then execute the vision. You know, with the exception of a handful of clients, a lot of times the people that we work with have never really stepped into real advertising before. And that gives us the opportunity to help educate our customers, and then from the ground up kind of create this expectation. And so when I was in college, I studied advertising. My major was in advertising, did a lot with regard to like advertising competitions and those kind of things. And I wanted really, really badly to go work at some agency like GSD&M in Austin, or McGarrah-Jessee, or like agencies like Ogilvy and Mather, et cetera, like big agencies. I just wanted that so bad and never could get hired. And so I just created my own job until I could get hired somewhere. And then here we are. I'm still not hired anywhere. Yeah. But, you know, to answer your question, I learned very quickly that executive producing and directing can be tough. And we pull it off because we have a great team. And I do enjoy directing a lot, but it's really hard for me to separate making a creative decision from an actual business decision on set when you're trying to execute the very best version of whatever it is you've sold as the EP, right? But I really like examples like Loki's Body Shop or Bivens Point, because I just acted as the creative director there. And what we do is I'll sit with a client, we'll listen to what their goals are, we'll create a brief off of that, which is like the sandbox that I'd mentioned earlier. And then I hand it to one of my hitters. And in my experience, as long as you know you have the right man or woman in place to execute whatever job on set as an executive producer or creative director, your job is to just set the stage and then set back or step back and let your hitters hit. And things like Bivens Point or projects like Loki's Body Shop have become some of our better pieces of content because we have a really good understanding of what the client's trying to accomplish. We approach it very creatively, very intentionally. I take a step back there because I've done the hard work. I've got it sold. I've got the client bought in on an idea. And then I let my director direct and I let him work with the DP he wants to work with. And I come in when they need me or want my input. And I'm there on set hanging out and vibing with the client. But one of the things that I've learned over the years is if you try to have this chokehold on a job and you've hired really good people, all you're doing is ruining the job. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And if you don't allow that breath, if you don't allow that life to happen inside of the project, it's not going to be what you wanted it to be. And, you know, I think it was Cliff Kingsbury who's coaching for the Arizona Cardinals now. He said sometimes coaching is just stepping back, right? And I think the same thing could be applied to management if you have the team in place to be able to execute it at a high level. And I think that one of my biggest strengths is not necessarily the creative vision or whatever, but it's my ability to be able to connect people. And I think that the relationships are such a big part of film in general. And I naturally feel like I'm much better at relationships than I am at making pretty pictures. I know what a pretty picture looks like. And a lot of times we can execute that right as a director, as a creative director or an EP or whatever. But what I take great pride in is being able to connect, I feel like, at a deep level with crew and with people that work with the Lemieux brand to make sure that we're doing ultimately what's best for the client, right?
For sure.
And that's what's helped to show success.
You're talking about these hitters, these heavy hitters that you have, that you've connected with. We talk about this every show, is how you go about meeting people, because as I'm realizing myself, like, you can only do so much by yourself. You need other people and their talents. How do you go about finding these talented people and connecting with them? Do you have a strategy for networking, or is it something you just, people are drawn to you? Or
I don't know if people are drawn. People might be drawn to Lemieux Company now, but they definitely weren't. You know, and it's funny, like, I wouldn't consider myself like a super humble guy. I think I've got a lot of confidence and sometimes that bleeds over into cockiness. but I'm not afraid to go and say, hey man, I need help. Hey, I don't know what I'm doing. Hey, I need you to help me not look like I'm a freaking moron, right? networking is a lot easier now than it was 2 or 3 years ago for me because we have a portfolio now. But I would say, and it's the reason JP and I are friends, right? We did Boring as Hell and I called Jared to come help me cast a vision and help me learn how to do production. And Boring as Hell came out. It was a hit. Jared's name was tied to it, right? And so a lot of people were like, okay, let's pay a little bit of attention to what's going on. And so JP reached out to me and was like, hey man, I'm just trying to talk with cool directors and trying to help build my own network. And I'd seen his work with Schultz and I'd seen his reel and I was like, okay, cool. I don't know when I'll ever get another cool job, but when I do, I'll call you. And later on that year, we had a client called Mentoring Minds, which was wanting to do, they're like a nationwide educational publisher, and they had a product called ThinkUp. And so JP,
yes, I really like that ad.
JP was the director of photography on that. And I was still very, very green. I mean, I didn't know what a gaffer did. I didn't know what a grip did. I didn't know like any of this stuff, right? And JP helped me produce that. And he brought in guys like Richard Porter, Scott Payne, Tweety Francis as a first AC. He helped me bring in a lot of the crew that we eventually used to shoot that, right? And You get on set and you just be yourself, right? And people will either like you or they don't. What I've learned is that if you're trying to be a good person, you'll be a good person, right? Like the bad parent doesn't know they're being a bad parent, right? They just are being. my biggest deal is I realized that I can't, living in Amarillo, living in a small town, right? Kind of like this hometown Hollywood idea that you've got going here, living in this tiny, like this place so far away from the industry, it's painfully obvious to me that I can on my own create the kind of content that I want to make. And we've got a cool little film community here, crew here, but if I'm wanting to get where I'm wanting to go and do national ad X, Y, or Z, or work on a really cool brand film, or, you know, get 250, 300, half a million dollar budgets, you've got to be able to bring hitters that know how to do that, right? Know how to handle that, know how to work from location to location, know how to do two or three company moves in a day over 5 days. Like, those things are new to me. And so I'd rather sacrifice money on the front end to bring those people in. And then when they're here, make sure that they eat right, make sure that they're taken care of, make sure that they feel like $1 million bucks.
Yeah, gushers.
And yes, yes, yes. Gushers on set are a must for us. But, you know, the way I've been able to network is through social media, through attaching myself to talented people, having them tell their buddies, hey, Wilson's cool to work with. And then when they do come work with us, make sure that they are treated in a way that makes them know, hey, I'm trying to build something here. You're on the forefront of it. I'm going to need you later. I'm going to invest in you, whether that's through food, accommodations, whatever. I mean, as long as it makes sense within the budget, but I'm willing to sacrifice short term in the relationship to try to gain long term and just be open and honest about that. Right. So that's kind of how I network is don't ever try to be the big dog. That's one thing I've learned is I'm never going to be some big dog, but I can go run with them. And then by extension, other folks might think you're a big dog in and of yourself.
I think that's really powerful that you just said that. I didn't even know what a gaffer or a grip was, and you're able to do through the people you connected with an ad that looks like $1 million bucks. And so you don't even have to know it all.
No, you don't have to know crap. Yeah, you have to have a vision. You have to know what you want it to look like. You have to know how to lead people. You have to know how to do it. But I still don't know, you know, the best way to point an M18 at something, or what kind of diffusion needs to go in front of it to make it look really cool. I just know what looks really cool. I don't know how to grip or gaff, you know, some of the stuff that Porter does. I don't know any of that. You know what I mean? Like, a C-stand probably could kick my ass. You know what I'm saying? And like, if I went into a fight with a C-stand, I'd get whooped, right? But I know how to incentivize the guy to put it where I need to put it and make him feel like he's the freaking $1 million bucks for putting it there, right? I know how to tell a story through visuals and have my DP say, okay, cool, this is the way this can look the best. I know how to tell the client, look, we're about to knock your competition on its with something like this, right? And most of the clients that we work with have never had anything at all close to what we've done, and they've seen local commercials and they're like, oh, well, I don't know if I need a TV ad. And then they see our reel and they're like, hey, you can do that here? And it's like, yes, like I can cast a vision for a client to make sure that they feel like what we're doing is going to make them look like $1 million and then believe it myself, right? And so you don't have to be an expert in all the places. You have to be a good motivator. You have to be a servant of the people that you bring on. And you have to realize that even though your name's on the check, even though your name's on the product, it ain't all about you, and know when to make sure that other folks win, right?
Yeah.
It's funny. I talk a lot about in networking. I think that this actually might be great advice. It's worked for me anyway. It's find ways to lose, or at least create the perception of loss, right? And so, like, make sure that somebody feels like you're taking care of them. I don't mind buying people dinner. I don't mind buying somebody a pack of cigarettes on set. I don't mind buying somebody Coca-Cola or something like that extra if they need it, right? Like, okay, cool. Like, I've lost something. Or even if we have a dispute, right? Like, if there's a gaffer on set that's like, hey, man, I worked X, Y, or Z here. Okay, cool. We'll make sure that you're compensated for that. You know, I had a producer that helped us put together this thing that was supposed to be this great, big, awesome, live recorded gala in a studio in New York. And it was going to be this really cool thing. And she'd worked for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks on getting us different bids because the budget kept dancing all over the place. And they ended up killing the job. And so I like called her and said, hey, I want to be able to give you a kill feed, and paid her for the work that she'd done, even though it was at cost to us. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like people going to bat for you. And we don't do this all the time, but when we can, it's important to invest in those folks that help you to succeed, period. And if you can create situations to where, you know, they, even in conflict, where they feel like they've won and sometimes feel like you've lost, that relationship over the next 5, 10, 15 years for me is way more important than that $500 to $1,500 to $3,000 that you lose in the moment. It stings, but I would rather it sting and put a Band-Aid on it than be crippled without that person 3, 4 months, a year down the road.
Wow. I think it's really inspiring to see how much you care about investing in people. I mean, I've been on some sets where people are like, after this job, obviously, the emphasis on people wasn't made.
Well, and I'm in a unique position, right? Because like I'm not going on set as a PA or a first AC or whatever. I'm going on set as the guy that writes the check, right? Like I went from DSLR on a Manfrotto photo tripod to, you know, let's talk about in the same year, let's talk about like Think Up going from, you know, what one man banding, doing your thing, going to like having it like a 10 ton grip truck and like 20 people on set. And there was no in between, right? Like I went from video guy to executive producer over the course of 4 months and realized, oh shoot, we're playing with the big boys right now. And if I don't treat them right, it's my butt. And that's what I talk about when I talk about being a humble narcissist. Yeah, if you put me in a meeting, I'm gonna tell you I'm the guy, and I'm gonna tell you we're gonna do better than the other folks, and I'm gonna tell you we're gonna make the hell out of something, and I do truly believe it. But I know that I can't go into a room and say that unless I've got a team of folks behind me that are willing to believe in us and do it. And so, yes, do I think that Lemieux Company hung the moon? Do I think that we're the best to ever do it? Do I tell clients we've got access to the best filmmakers across the country that aren't, you know, that are up and coming, et cetera? Yes, I tell them that, but I can't tell them that without them people really being able to be on board. And so I invest in those folks because I went from one side of the video spectrum all the way to the other side in terms of where I'm at right now very, very shortly, and was able to really understand that I can't do it without the people that brought me here. And I'm real big on dancing with the ones who brung you. I'm real big on, you know, these people have helped take my career to a completely new level. And I sure as hell didn't do it on my own. And I think that a lot of people that are living in small towns like Orange or Abbeville or whatever, like that should be your mentality too, is people will work. You've just got to find the money. And if you're able to create really good content in towns like Lafayette or Orange or, you know, whatever, people will take notice. And you got to realize that your sauce on your own, where you can shoot the hell out of something or make a really cool edit, yeah, that's great. But if you're wanting to make content that you see on TV, content that's expensive, you need to put a team together. But it's not impossible to be able to do it in a small town like that, because everybody's close to some kind of big city, and a grip truck does drive. And so if you if you can make those connections, there's some things that are more expensive than others, but you can make it work.
The grip truck is on wheels for a reason. I like
it's
that.
It's a truck. You know what I mean? It's not a grip tray.
You had just said that you went from DSLR to big budget production, and now we know that you're able to do that through the connections you made and investing in people. What inspires such a jump in quality and production? Is it just seeing other people's ads and like, okay, what did they do? Oh, that's how they did it. I'm going to do it. Or because I know for a lot of people that it's very gradual. Like if you look at my own stuff, it's stuff that sucks, and then it just gradually gets a little less sucky. But little by little, there isn't like an enormous change. So how do you get from, like you said, DSLR to
right, whatever's next, right? And the thing is you look at guys like Ryan Booth, who can take a DSLR and make a motion picture and be beautiful, right? Like the camera or the gear is not what makes a film good, right? It's the filmmaker, right? And I think that's the deal that I try to drive home is, you know, I've had clients say, look, they got a big camera too. I said, yeah, baby, but they ain't got us. You know what I mean? Like a good filmmaker makes good film. The camera doesn't. The audio gear, well, actually, the audio gear probably is important. But all that being said, what inspires that jump is I'm like very competitive person. This is how I feed my family. This is, you know, I couldn't get hired anywhere else to do this, so I had to create the job myself. And there's this kind of like chip on your shoulder of like, look, if I fail, I'm out, bro. Like, it's, that's, you know, like, where else am I gonna go? Because we're not moving anytime soon, right? I can't, like, I still, there's still this like deep rooted fear in me that I wouldn't get hired anywhere else and my family would live in squalor. if this thing worked. And so, late 2016, early 2017, there's a guy here in Amarillo that moved that was like his own freelance video guy, and he was like super good, right? And we had the same kind of cameras and we were buddies to a certain extent, but we competed a lot and we were doing the same kind of production. And in my opinion, him on his own was better than me on my own. And I was like, man, I've got to find a unique selling proposition. And so I'd built this relationship with Amarillo National Bank, and they liked my vibe. They liked working with me, and they're like, hey, do you want to do our Super Bowl ad? And I was like, yes. and you know, it was so funny. I don't want to disclose the budget, but at the time I thought it was huge. But it really wasn't compared to some other stuff that we've been able to do lately. But I thought the budget was gigantic. And I said, sweet, I can rent an Alexa Mini. Right? Wow. But that was how I was like, okay, cool. Most people, especially in small towns, will make purchasing decisions with regard to content based on image quality to a big part, right? So the visual weight of the production makes a big difference. And so I knew that if I can make something look like you see it on TV, then we can make that happen. And I was foolish enough to think that the camera was what did that. It was not the light. And so anyway, that being said, competition drove that, and competition still drives me, right? In terms of like, okay, cool. Yeah. So like, we're doing what we're doing in Amarillo. What are they doing in Dallas, and how's that setting them apart? And you've got insane, you know, filmmakers like Ryan Pauly, Matthew Rojas, just to name a couple down there in Dallas, and you saw their work and you're like, okay, well, WTF are they doing? Do you know what I mean? and again, it was like, don't try to be the big dog, just go run with them, right? And you make these relationships and you realize, okay, cool, they're working with this and this and this and renting from here and doing that. And, you know, they'll be kind and open and honest with you and try to help you do whatever it is. But what inspires a lot for me, if I'm being really honest, is just like, I've got this dream to go do really high quality advertising and sometimes films as a company. And I need people to make that happen, and I need access to those relationships to be able to like accomplish that. But it's just like, look, I see what I see on TV, and I always think, why not us? Why not me? Why can't I do that? Right? Like, and it's a very Southern thing, right? As you see one old boy, he does X, Y, or Z, and then you've got the other old boy that says, hold my beer and watch this, right? Like, that's... That's just in me. I'm one of five boys that my parents have had, and I'm like the second to last and very much so like a middle child. And it's like, you know, there's that, I got to go get mine in me or I'm not going to get it. And so it's just, how can we push the envelope with every single project? And how can I make sure that like, I'm outdoing myself and not just resting on, our successes in the past, because like that doesn't matter. You're not getting paid from those projects anymore, right? If I were a better executive producer and knew to hire a lawyer, I might still be making money on those projects, but like I'm not now, right? And so with all that being said, like those projects are in the past. Like you can only ride off that success for so long. You have to keep leaning in, keep digging in, and keep pushing.
I guess one question, a little bit, it is related, not as related, but you're a family man. You have a family of six, is that right?
Yes. My wife and I, and we have four kids.
So I have two kids, and I know that work and having a family is difficult. How do you balance work life with family life? Because at least, or from your Instagram, it looks like definitely your family is really important to you. I don't know. How do you balance that?
Well, I could say everything that I want to say here but I think that you should ask my wife, right? Like, she's the real judge on how well I'm doing there. But it is tough, man. I mean, I would say since late August till now, I've been sometimes a rough spot with my family, right? Like, I mean, in the middle of COVID, my wife is, and we were already homeschooling Madden, but like, my wife's been working on teaching our 11-year-old, and we've got three kids under the age of five. One's every bit of what you call terrible two, and then another one's a newborn. And then we have our oldest daughter, Nora, who's four and change, and like intentionally like wrecks the house and laughs, right? And so it's just like, it's tough. It's really tough trying to like build a company, build relationships, build good content, make enough money to feed all six of us and keep us in a house and, you know, and allow us to do fun family things. And the weight of that, I think, is also something that drives what we're doing here in the company, because if I fail, you know, there is no safety net to a certain extent. But yeah, being able to balance it, it's tough. I mean, and having a good community of people. I mean, I go to therapy. I'll be like real honest, and I would encourage anybody that does this, whether you're in a small town or not, to go to therapy and talk to somebody. It's not a point of weakness. It's actually a point of strength to figure out why you act the way that you act. And, you know, therapy has been helpful for me for a lot of things that I'm working on. And just, you have to be intentional. As intentional as I am in terms of what I'm saying on this podcast, which is to a certain extent very calculated, right? To what the way we edit a project or the way that I'm pitching something to a client, all those things are very calculated. And I'm not saying being a calculated dad or whatever, but I'm saying you have to be very intentional with regard to when you're home, you're home. I have a tendency to catastrophize, and if something doesn't get done ASAP and as well as it can be within, you know, X amount of, you know, allotted time frame or whatever, everything's gone to hell. And so like, I'll take this weight of sometimes depression, sadness, disappointment at the office and go home and just be a crap dad and a crap husband, right? And other times I'll bring that success home and be the best freaking cool dad ever, right? But like the way that I operate at home should not be contingent on what's going on here at the office. And working very intentional with regard to separating the two has been something that I'm, you know, I'm not saying I'm good at it by any means, but what I am saying is that I am trying to be intentional about that. Yes, it's really cool to hear your kids tell their friends, my dad made that commercial, or my dad's working on this, or my dad makes movies, or my girls think that I made all the Harry Potters and I'm going to let them think that. And to sit there and watch football games with them, and then they judge the ads and say, that's a good ad, that's a bad ad. And they only care about the advertising because they know that that's what dad does. Those are cool things, right? Like I'm about
for
it.
Sure.
But like at the end of the day, like, they don't see dad the creative, or dad with like an office, or dad with, you know, people making cool stuff. Eventually they will, but they just want dad, right? And like, yeah, I've got a 2.5-year-old that every night since she could walk lays down in her bed, and by 2 a.m. she's in ours, and her feet are in my face and her elbows are in my side. And you know, just trying to enjoy those things, right? Like, enjoy having these little babies that look up to you, and not feel the weight of feeding them all the time, and not feel the weight of being successful so they can be proud of their dad all the time, and just being, right? I think that, and this is, I'm answering this in a way that's probably not what you were looking for.
No, this is great.
But I think in freelance, and I think Travis, you'll see this too, is you'll feel this weight of like, you know, you're stressed out because of work, because you've got a lot of it. And then there'll be times where you're stressed out because of work, because you have none of it. And so many times you just feel like you're just always stressed. And me, I'm kind of a person that's always waiting for the other foot to drop. I've been running from this other foot for the last 6 years that I've been doing this. And people talk a lot about it's okay to not be okay. But it's also okay to be okay, right? It's okay to just enjoy the success when you have it and not be worried that none of it's ever going to come again. And that's hard. But all of that to say, you know, how do you put your family first? Well, it's like you try really hard and you do what I do. I'm doing all this stuff because I want to feed my family and I want to be a cool dude, video man, whatever, you know. But how do I keep my family first? my answer is I don't. And I try really hard and want really to, but it's a constant struggle. And I think that whoever listens to this, whatever, is like, you ain't gonna get every day right, you ain't gonna get every week right. Sometimes there's months that you don't get right. But as long as you're trying to get it right, you know, I think I said earlier, a bad parent doesn't know they're being a bad parent.
Yeah.
Just try not to be a bad parent and things kind of fall in place.
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you for being open about being intentional. I think there's a lot of weight in just trying to work at it. And there's the danger in not trying, like you said, the bad parent doesn't know because they're probably not trying. I don't know if I make any sense, but
man, it's the easiest crap in the world, dude. Yes. Like, it's the easiest thing in the world to not try and to play a victim and act like the world's falling down on you and that you're living in a small town, so you can't be successful, or you're, you know, you've got too many kids, so of course something's going to fall through the cracks, or you've got, like, you know, you lost a job because of nepotism or whatever. Yeah. You know what? It's the easiest thing to sit there and play victim and act like the world's going to go against you, but it's also easy to just show up and to just try and to be optimistic and to think, you know what, like, this is going to run my way, this is going to go my way, and will it to happen. And a lot of people don't think that they can do that. Everybody sits around and waits on something to happen to them, and I think it's, you know, baloney. There are things in life that happen to us that we can't control, but I'm a firm believer that we have, in a lot of ways, and you know what, I mean, and I'm saying this, and you know, this could very much so sound like white privilege. I'm a middle-class white Christian male, so things have not been hard for me the way that they are hard for others, but I do believe that to a certain extent, we can control what happens in our lives, and that we have to be intentional, not only to our circumstances, to the people around us, but be intentional to ourselves. Because the easiest thing in the world is to not try and claim to be the victim. But no winner ever got punched in the mouth every day and did nothing about it.
I love that. So speaking about getting punched in the mouth and getting back up and doing things with COVID and everything happening, What's next on the horizon? What are you fighting for next?
So there's work that we did back in August that we did very safely and within guidelines and very intentionally. That'll be coming out, I don't know when, but either late this year or early 2020, that I think is the most ambitious project and best project I've ever done in my career.
Wow.
And I can't talk a lot about it right now, but I do think it's like the coolest thing we've ever done. JP actually shot it with me. He and I worked together on that project, and the majority of the crew was right here in Amarillo. We had a producer from out of town, and we had a DP from out of town, and then we brought in a camera car. But the majority of the people that worked on this job were from right here in Amarillo. And it slaps, dude. I'm really excited about it. And that'll be coming out soon. But outside of that, we did one animated short film that's on our website, and I wrote and directed that.
Oh, yeah. That one's about mental health, right?
Yes, dude.
Yes. That was awesome.
Yeah, I love that. It's something that's super close to my heart. But, you know, most of what we've done this year has been just remote editing stuff, and then helping to create digital events. We've got a company that we've partnered with outside of Dallas. I guess it's Fort Worth area that have put on a lot of events, and we, our job is to, you know, help make them cool and run smoothly through video. And so that's what we've done over the last really 9 months or so. So we've had a couple cool projects here and there, but then have leaned a lot on remote editing. And so that's basically it. I mean, there's not a lot of cool, sexy coming out for a little while. And to be honest, January looks pretty, I mean, going into 2021 looks like it's going to be slow. You know, but it's okay. It's okay. It's okay to, it's okay. It's okay. It's like that, it's like that video, that kid crying that starts laughing at first and starts crying. It's like, that's like me looking into the first quarter of 2021. It's just like, okay, here we are.
Well, that's a perfect mental image. I'm excited to see what you have coming, and it sounds like you're adapting in the ways that you can to make things happen. And I think your work just speaks for you, and everything you're involved with just seems to just be pure gold. So I have confidence that 2021 is going to be awesome for you.
Well, that's very kind of you, man. I do want to say this, though. I mean, I do want to say, like, the stuff that I'm involved in, yes, I'm kind of at the epicenter of a lot of it, but it's not good just because of me. It's good because of the homies that surround us, and it's the good because of the people that have bought into me and the people that believe in me and people that want to work for me. But it's not me, you know. It's, I mean, I could name off 40 to 45 different people that have made all those things worthy of, you know, being reached out to or whatever, or, you know, worthy for our clients, worthy of being talked about and being whatever they are. But I ain't nothing without the ones who brung me. You know what I mean? And I cannot stress that enough to especially people around, you know, in these small areas, is that, like, look, if you think that you're going to be this hero, if you think that you're going to be this super rock star, living in a small town and do it on your own, you're wrong. However, if you take the time to invest in others, put them above yourself and treat them like $1 million because one day they can make you that much, then you can be super successful.
I love it. I think one thing I was just thinking about to myself not too long ago, I was looking at who I am as a person, and there are times in my life when I thought, maybe I'm a pretty interesting dude. I'm fun to be around. And then there's other times where I'm like, man, I'm just the most boring person on earth. Why would anyone stick around?
Right, yeah.
And then I realized that the times that I feel like I am my best is the times that I was the most connected to other people. Like the times I was going to school and I was around a bunch of people every day and experiencing other people's lives and being very involved, versus the time where I was stuck at an agency in my own little office. I had very little human interaction. That changed me as a person. And so I think who you are and who you network with, who you're connected to on a regular basis, it becomes who you are.
Right. You are who you hang around.
You are you. Your team is your team, but you are also your team. I think that's maybe the best way I could put it. So there's a lot of value in you and your team. And you obviously have built an awesome team. So what's the best way to connect with you and follow you and get to see these exciting projects that you're working on?
Instagram. Probably the best. If you follow me on Twitter, you're just going to see me like raise hell about how bad Florida State football is. really. So like Twitter, go ahead and follow me, but I'm not a pro on there at all. And I don't care. But Instagram, if you want to follow me, you can follow both the Lemieux Company and myself. My Instagram handle, I need to go. Yeah. Is just, Wilson.Lemieux. It's Wilson, like the volleyball, dot Lemieux, like the hockey player, L-E-M as in Mary, I-E-U-X. And then if you want to follow the Lemieux Company Instagram, I think it's just Lemieux.company. Lemieux like the hockey player, company like the word.
Perfect. I will leave links everywhere I possibly can. And if you are listening and you are not following the stuff that he's doing, then you are missing out. So I think that will end the show, but really thank you for being on here and sharing all of your wisdom that you have. I've learned a ton.
Well, I don't know if I'd call it wisdom. I'd call it falling backwards into something. But I appreciate it, man.
And that's it. Thank you for listening. I hope this helps you do great work, be the artist you want to be, and helps you not be afraid to jump in with both feet and make things happen in your film community. Be sure to follow Wilson and the Lemieux Company on social media to keep up to date with all their exciting projects. If you enjoyed this podcast, I encourage you, do not subscribe. You may be writing your positive review on iTunes at this very moment, but people would start finding the show, and it might get a little out of hand, so refrain if you can. Thanks again for listening, and stay tuned for our next awesome guest on the Hometown Hollywood Podcast.
So I did I did college radio when I was in college. I was the music director.
Oh, really?
Slash general manager, and I had a show on KWTS, the 91.1 FM. We listened to the top 21 in college radio from late 2012 or early 2012 all the way through 2013. In my very humble opinion, it was the best show that's ever been on that station. So,
I believe it. I haven't heard it, but I believe it.
I think we had like 6 listeners.
Hey, well, you'll find something similar to this show.
We're in it together, brother. We're in it together.